Welcome to the New York Skies Astronomy Seminar for 2023, April 7, and I be John Pasmino. Our topic for today is halos around the sun, relating to atmospheric effects which produce, among other formations, rings or halos centered on the sun. The atmospheric effects can include spots, patches, and arcs, but they're collectively often called atmospheric optics. You have the two files, I hope, the audio you're listening to, and you need the video file with the slideshows. If you're only hearing the seminar, go to www.nysakiesa.org. On the jump words, among them on the home page, you'll see audio, video, files. Kick it. Now on the AV files page, you see some text, which you can read on your own some other time, but it does tell you why you need both files. It also reminds you about the New York Skies email group where you can banter and chat about our profession with other astronomers. Then follows a list with links of all of our digital seminars. We started in February 2021. The ones for 2021 are gathered together. There's a link for that. And at the bottom is the ones for this year. And you're looking for halos around the sun. And the links there are for the MP3 file, the audio, and PPT file, the video. So once you got the two files on your computer, you fire up the video file and stand on slide number one. Slide one answers the quiz I left you last time during the Omega Centauri session. I asked, when, due to precession, will Omega Centauri leave our sky and no longer rise? And I suggested that you play with your planetarium program to do this. And I got a whole bunch, maybe a dozen or so responses, and all of them were pretty much on the mark. So slide one gives my own results, and to cover some of the dispersion of responses, I gave you the lat of New York, 40 degrees, 45 minutes, which is what my planetarium program puts it at. Now bear in mind, New York is a very large area city, and the author simply picked some point within it. For all I know, he picked the Bethesda statue in Central Park. But in any case, that's the lot. And I worked it out both ways, with and without refraction. And with the geometric method, no refraction, Omega will no longer rise after the year 2350, and with refraction will no longer rise after 2460. So you see that a horizon benefiting from refraction, which was one of the factors helping you during that exercise, that you get another 110 years look at the cluster, after which you got to go move south. Okay, now we go to slide 2, which is the title slide. It summarizes the AV files page, except that it says if you're looking at the slides and you're missing the audio, go back to the AV file page. Then I give supplemental reading, Soul Halo, SOLHALO .htm, is an article I wrote in the year 2001, following a couple of years of major solar halo displays over the city. And I made incremental adjustments to it since then, the latest a week or so ago. A typical solar halo is illustrated in slide 3. You can be minding your own little business or large business, and you get this funny feeling, what's going on up there in the sky? All right, clouds, nice clear blue sky, and there's a ring around the sun, and it looks huge, or as we say in the city, humongous. So you grab your cell phone or your pocket camera and you get a nice picture. The center is overexposed because that's the sun, but there's a beautiful ring around the sun, and we notice a couple of things. It has the colors of a rainbow. Sometimes, like here, they're not overly saturated, but definitely it's reddish on the inside, and the outer edge tapers toward blue or purple. And it moves with the sun. That is, if it endures for many minutes or an hour, as it can, then as the sun migrates across the sky, it takes the halo with it. So it's definitely something in the air, and it's above the clouds because the clouds pass in front of it, way up in the atmosphere, and presumably caused by the sun itself. In 4, we see another scene of a solar halo, but the author hid the sun behind a tree. You can see it peeking between the leaves. Again, the spectral tinting and a very quiet, very peaceful aspect to it. Something that tells you today is going to be a good day. Now, when you do take pictures of the halos, nothing special is needed, but it'd be a good idea to hide the sun behind some street furniture, edge of a building, or something like that. But try to get the sun near the very edge so that the little glow around the sun tells you the exact position of the sun. But sometimes you can't do this, and you can only get a picture of part of the halo, or there's no good strong obstruction. So if you have steady hands and a camera you can work with one hand, or your cell phone, you put your thumb over the sun and take the picture. And the exposure is directly off the sky, which means that the foreground would typically come out too dark, which is fine and dandy. You want the sky features to show up, and not like here, you don't see very much detail in the tree. Also, it would be helpful, especially if you have a camera, if the lens allows you a wide field of view, like 50 or 60 degree field of view. I have no idea what the normal field of view is for cell phones, and in almost every case, you don't have much flexibility. You don't have zoom features in a cell phone, or if you do, it's kind of fiddly to get at them using the little icons on the screen, and the display may go away. Solar halos and other similar phenomena cannot be predicted or anticipated. They seem to come regardless of the hour of the day and regardless of the surrounding weather conditions. It can be hot, it can be cold, there can be snow underground, or there can be clouds in the sky, there might be haze or smoke pollution or whatever, but so long as the sky is generally clear, and the halo can occur. The duration varies widely from literally a few minutes to most of the day. We'll see why that's so, but that's a good way to get a picture without burning out the central part of the field of view. And halos, in slide 5, can be seen everywhere in the world. Now this one is taken from a town with some stubby skyscrapers, and the author put the sun behind one of the buildings and got this nice halo picture. The only places where you will see more than average number per year is in the high north or high south latitudes, like in an Arctic or Antarctic setting. The reason being that the conditions in the upper atmosphere are favored by the generally lower temperature. But otherwise, in compiling this session, I had pictures from all over the world, from the equatorial regions, like from Nigeria, central India, high elevation in the Andes Mountains, sea coast locations, urban areas, farm areas, deserts. It doesn't really matter, because the cause and the mechanism to make halos happens to be in the stratosphere above most weather, and certainly higher than except the extremely tall mountains, like the Himalayas or the, I guess that's it. Even the Andes don't even reach that high. Clouds, which usually spoil pictures of the sky, like star pictures or northern lights, and wreck hell with your pictures of meteor showers, actually can enhance and beautify halo pictures. Slide 6 is a nice example. But be as it may, clouds could hamper viewing or even recognizing that a halo is in effect, because it may be camouflaged in the clouds, or it may be covered by a cloud when you happen to look up. So whenever you're outdoors in generally clear sky, every so often look up toward the sun. Now, it's not a good idea to look at the sun. So if the sky really is clear, you'll be dazzled by the sun, and you could, with repeated attempts, cause temporary or permanent impairment to your vision. So if you are walking around outdoors, hide the sun, even if it's just by your hand, and just scan the sky around it. You don't have to do this every few minutes, like if you're waiting for a traffic light, or you're doing window browsing in a commercial district. Move under an awning or step into a doorway and take a look at the sky. You won't always see halos, but because they come and go as they will, without regard to the ground level weather or temperature or humidity or whatever else. The stratosphere is its own world. Now, you saw a few pictures, and the halo occupied various portions of the field of view, because the pictures were taken by the authors with whatever camera they had to hand. Now, if you're a shutterbug, you may have in your shoulder bag or in your jacket pocket a point-and-shoot camera for grab shots, or increasingly so, cell phones are incorporating picture-taking facilities. That is, if you have a smartphone as opposed to a cell phone, which makes phone calls. Any case, so the field of view of the camera that took the picture varies all over the place. But the author of this picture in slide 7, first, and he annotated the picture himself, that's not my work. He put the sun behind a lamp, and then, with his free hand, he put his thumb next to the sun and spread his fingers out, and the pinky grazes the halo. Now, if you do any kind of stargazing, you know that you can use your hand and fingers and knuckles for rough estimates of angles on the sky. And one of those tricks is the spread out fingers, thumb to pinky, is about 20 degrees. So the solar halo is uniform whenever it appears, 22 degrees radius, and that's to the inner edge. The inner edge tends to be rather well defined. The outer edge kind of blends into the sky around it, and it has some breadth. Sometimes it's narrow, and sometimes very broad, a degree or so across. But the inner radius, 22 degrees, which the author points out. And you can use your hand for other measurements. You see other kinds of atmospheric effects you can use. The outstretched fist with the thumb tucked in is 10 degrees across the knuckles, each knuckle being 2.5 degrees. Another method is, if you have with you a small ruler, 15-cent ruler, you hold that at arm's length, the centimeter marks are surprisingly close to 1 degree apart. So if you did that and hold it against a halo, it would measure somewhere in the area 20 degrees. Now, it varies a little bit because of the length of a person's arm, but in a pinch, it is very, very handy. But that is the size. So it can stretch diameter-wise from the horizon to halfway up. Or if the sun be in high sky, it would cover the entire overhead region. Now, I mentioned a couple of times about the stratosphere and the cores of halos and way up there. So in slide 8, we're going to talk a little bit about the atmosphere. It's a kind of standard diagram. It emphasizes clouds, but it gives a vertical profile of the atmosphere up to about 8 or 9,000 meters. And you have the clouds. The low clouds are down there, that's the cumulus clouds, nimbostratus, some stratus clouds, and then above that you have the altocumulus and altostratus clouds. But then at the very top, 8,000 or so meters, you have cirrus clouds, the ones that look like tufts or feathers. And that is where your halos are produced. Those clouds and ice crystals surrounding them, whether the clouds are there or not. In other words, clouds will form out of ice crystals which are so dense that they're now opaque. The other ice crystals are spread out, so you still see between them, but they're there. So the ice crystals up in that region are the ones that will cause halos. So let's take a look more about the ice crystals, which you actually see here on the ground. You see them in frost on a window. Of course, snowflakes are made of frozen water. But these are atmospherically based ice. Ice is the word for frozen water. In slide 9, we have a little chemistry and physics. It shows a water molecule in the upper left corner. Of course, you can't see atoms, and they don't have any real appearance. So we often represent atoms by little globes, balls. And I know many of us who are technically educated, we played with molecule building kits in school. We might even have purchased one from a science toy store. The little balls representing the atoms and the number of holes in them represent the number of other atoms it can attach to. And then you have a whole bunch of small rods. And to make a water molecule, you pick up a ball representing oxygen, which has two holes in it, and you put a peg in each. And they pick up two little balls that represent hydrogen that has only one hole in each. And you stick them on the pegs, and you have what's in the upper left corner, H2O, that is two hydrogens and one oxygen, number one for single oxygen, the number is left out, so it's not H2O1, H2O. It's so universally known by rote, almost as if it's just another word for water, and it's international. So I've seen in airports, the Staten Island Ferry Depot in New York, water fountain labeled H2O, meaning that any person will recognize immediately that that's a water-sipping fountain. In the lower part of the frame, we see the physics of the molecule, the length of the bond, the separation between the two atoms, is very small, about 95 picometers. P, Papa, I, C, Charlie, O, one of the metric prefixes. And if you're into radio engineering or radio tinkering, you know that condensers are often dimensioned in picofarads, or before the word pico was adopted as the prefix, we called it a micro-micro, that is E minus 12, it's beyond billions. So that's the definition of the letter P in that length dimension. The angle between the two hydrogens is about 105 degrees. Why is it not 180? Why is it not 90? It's all a function of the distribution of the electrons in the hydrogen and the oxygen. The nuclei themselves do not touch and stick together. The electrons around the nucleus interact and link with the electrons of the other atoms, and the structure of the two atoms, hydrogen and oxygen, compel them to unite in a bent molecule, like you see in the upper left corner. Now that's pretty important. Molecules are typically neutral in electric charge, and the hydrogen in this molecule has one positive charge. In fact, the hydrogen is a proton, positive charge, and the oxygen, which has extra electrons in it now because it's in a molecule, has a negative 2 units of charge. So minus 2 plus 1 plus 1 is 0. But it is not symmetrical. If I were to draw a vertical line, let's see in the lower picture a little easier. I draw a horizontal line that cuts between the oxygen and hydrogen. Above the line I have excess negative, and below that line I have excess positive. So the molecule, although as a whole is neutral, in detail it's polarized, having a plus and a minus end. And that is crucial for the formation of crystals. In 10, which is a pretty busy picture, so number one, ignore the text in the lower left. You can read that on your own another time. But in the lower right, we have a bunch of disorganized water molecules, not necessarily ice. Bear in mind that the molecule remains the same whether it's in liquid form or solid form, or for that matter in a vapor for steam. There's a steam, liquid water, and ice all have the same molecular makeup, but what changes is their motion and ability to attract to each other. So in the lower right, we have disorganized molecules of water, such as in a liquid. That is, they don't hold their shape, but they settle to the bottom of whatever vessel they're contained in. In the upper right, we have a snowflake which It's actually a real snowflake, not one cut out of paper like you make during Christmas decorations. No, it's a real snowflake. And it's made of tiny crystals, which in the aggregate give you the six-sided figure. In the upper left, we see how that comes about. Remember I said that the molecule is polarized. The oxygen end has a slight negative charge, and the two hydrogens form the positive side. Now, if another molecule comes near to it and is moving slowly, and you make the movement slow by cooling the molecules so they don't agitate as much, you're lowering their temperature. So when they come close to each other slowly, there's time and room for the hydrogen end of one molecule, positive charge, to be attracted toward the negative end of the adjacent molecule, that's the oxygen. They're not chemically bound together, they're electrostatically attached. And so what will happen is the molecules click together and they form, as in the upper left, a hexagonal cell. And the piling up or tiling out of these hexagonal cells creates the crystal which in bulk form made the snowflake in the upper right. Now, if you capture snowflakes, say on a soft velvet, dark colored velvet outdoors, and right away before it melts, look at it under a magnifier, an upended low power eyepiece, for instance, you'll see tiny crystals. They'll be sparkling in the daylight. That's the key to making ice crystals, the electrostatic attachment of polarized molecules of water when their motion is slow enough to let them come and actually stick together. Once they stick together, they, excuse the word, freeze. Frozen water are molecules of water which have moved so slowly that they're able to attach together and form a solid. A photomicrogram, that is a picture taken with a microscope type setup, is in slide 11, which shows in a laboratory ice crystals. There's nothing different between the ice crystals produced at ground level or artificially in a lab or science experiment using your freezer of the refrigerator than those in the upper atmosphere. So the experiments we do with crystals on the ground apply to what the crystals in the stratosphere will do. And you can see they are small hexagonal columns or pillars or rods. And they're laying down there. You can see the topmost three faces. They're apparently lying down on maybe a microscope stage of some sort. I don't see any that are actually standing upright. But those are what the crystals look like. In size, you can make giant crystals, like a human height ice crystal. But the idea is that when they form in nature or in a confinement of a workshop, they will only be a few millimeters across. Now, please be careful. I don't mean a block of ice which you shape by shaving and sawing and cutting into a hexagonal shape. That is not a crystal. However, the chips that are thrown out when you do the cutting may contain in them this kind of crystal. I also do not mean a jewel which has different faces on it. That is artificially cut. And that's not how a jewel. You see these stupid movies where they're looking for a precious mineral like kryptonite or some such. And in this mine, the guy shines a lamp around and he sees it glittering on something on the ceiling, and hanging, embedded in the rock, is a jewel, stage prop, of course. And that's it. Yeah. Yes, he takes the chips away to the rock, and he gets the jewel, and it has thousands of facets on it, and it's glittering in the light of the flashlight. Well, that's not what jewels are. You can get crystals. Crystals are formed by the natural alignment of the molecule. A jewel is such a crystal which has been cut along lines of least resistance, that is, cutting between the atoms of the previous picture, the upper left corner of that picture in slide 10. If you were to cut between the atoms, and so that they push apart the weak electrostatic binding, you get a facet. And it's the skill of a jewel cutter to slice a given crystal correctly. If he misses and he cuts into trying to separate a hydrogen from the oxygen, the entire crystal falls apart and essentially ruined the crystal, which pieces have essentially no value. I mean, he salvages his work by selling them to a company that makes abrasives or drill bits or something. It's no longer a jewel, it's just an industrial metal for abrasives. Yeah, that's what I mean by crystals. You may have grown crystals. You could get a crystal growing set where separately you get a fish bowl, let's say, a small fish bowl, and you pour, I forget what it is, it's a silicate liquid mixed with water, and then you put this in a place which is guaranteed to be quiet. You set it on a pillow in a quiet part of your house where it won't be disturbed, and you drop into it certain chemicals that came with the kit. And after a couple of days, you get crystals like this. They may be colored because of the chemical of the that's put in, but water makes crystals which are, excuse the pun, ice clear. So we have hexagonally based crystals. In slide 12, we see the two major forms. They actually are the same one, except for the height of the column. If the height is less than the diameter across the base, we generally call it a plate, or platelet, or tablet. If the height is greater than the diameter across the base, it's a pillar, or prism, or a column. Those are the two kinds of crystal. And the reason we make the distinction for the atmosphere is aerodynamically they behave differently. Tablets tend to float face up. That is, the end bases are parallel to the ground. They may twirl around the vertical axis, or they may wobble like precessing. On the other hand, the columns can either float horizontally and rotate along a horizontal axis, or they can actually arrange vertical and they rotate on a vertical axis, or they can be all jumbled up and mixed up. And those different orientations give rise to different effects as sunlight passes through them. And the strange thing is, now that we know the physics, which we sussed out in the early, about 1900, we sort of caught on to what was going on, and by 1920, it was a pretty matured study. Incidentally, the study of halos in a objective scientific sense began in the 1600s, and that was mainly better chronicling and recording them and taking measurements of the angular sizes and shapes. And in the 1700s, coming into the 1800s, we tried to hypothesize what in the atmosphere could make them. And of course, we didn't know the structure of the atmosphere until basically balloon flights and that is high elevation balloon flights and aviation, beginning of the 1900s. And then we were forced to understand these ice crystals because you're going to fly through them or hang up there in a balloon. So the technology and industry of aeronautics and aviation drove the study and science of atmospheric optics. So sunlight can interact with the ice crystals in one of three ways. They can be reflected off the faces of the crystal, refracted through the crystal, or a combination of both reflection and refraction. So in slide 13 are examples of reflection. In the upper right, sunlight hitting the side face of a column, which happens to be horizontal in this case, and in the lower left, a reflection off the base end of a tablet, which almost always are horizontally arrayed. I have not come across, convincingly anyway, of tablets floating in the atmosphere vertical, like coins on edge. And I don't know exactly where the breakpoint is where a tablet of a certain percent of the base radius can then flip over and become horizontal. I haven't figured that out yet. So just to say that you're definitely larger, a couple of times larger than the diameter, you got a column, and definitely less than the diameter, the crystal is a tablet. But in overall size, we're still talking down to several millimeters in size, and length, or diameter. So that's pure reflection. Note that the direction of the sunlight is diverted. So sunlight hitting, say the upper right, is heading toward the upper left, and if it did not hit the crystal, it will continue to the observer. The reflected ray is deflected here to the lower left, that is in that upper panel, and that, let's say, goes to the observer. So what happens is he sees a spot in the sky displaced from the sun by the angle between the incoming and outgoing rays. And the same assessment can be done in the lower panel, where the incoming ray is diverted roughly 90 degrees. So he would see, the observer would see a spot about 90 degrees away from the direction to the sun. By the way, these are illustrative pictures. They're not any way quantitatively correct. 14 shows two examples, again illustrative, of refraction, where the beam of sunlight goes into the crystal on one face and it leaves the crystal through one of the other faces. And we have for the tablet in the upper left, and it goes in through the base and comes out through one of the side faces. And for the column, it shows entering at one side face and leaving through another. Again, the sunlight that we see is displaced from the direct line to the sun by the amount of the bending of the ray of light inside the crystal. I don't have one for combined reflection refraction, but that can in fact happen. You can get a crystal where the ray enters and is refracted, reflects inside the crystal, and then leaves through another face for a second refraction. We'll see something like this with rainbows, although rainbows are not caused by ice, and they really ground level or shallow sky events. You almost cannot talk about solar halos because you're always going to get a question about rainbows. So rather than do all the talk about halos and have my peanut gallery say, rainbows, I saw rainbow, you didn't say anything about rainbow. Okay, so I'll include rainbows toward the end, and we'll see an example of combined refraction and reflection. So here is in 14, pure refraction. Now, specifically for the 22 degree halo, which is a rounded number, by the way, it's 21.9 something or other degree, but we round it off for the simplicity of designating the formation. It's also called a halo minor because there's another halo, we'll look briefly at it, 46 degree radius, which is the halo minor. Okay, so specifically for the halo minor in slide 15, we're looking at a cabinet drawing, of a crystal. The base face is toward us and the sides are extending behind it, like to the upper left. So we get in the upper left corner from sun, a ray entering through one face is refracted inside and it leaves through the second face beyond. Not the very adjacent face and not the opposite face, but the second face beyond. If you number the faces, one being the entry and going clockwise, it would be leaving through face number 3. Face 4 would be at the bottom the opposite face, and the deviation of the deflection is 22 degrees, meaning a sun ray which would have come straight to us is instead thrown 22 degrees away, and that will cause a spot in the sky 22 degrees away from the sun. Now these are horizontally oriented crystals, but not strictly so. They're more simply all jumbled up. So all around the sun, there will surely be a few which will be aligned to give you that deflection. So at every clock face angle around the sun, you will get spots of light which are dense enough to form a continuous ring all around the sun. How can we assure that this would actually be the case? Well, you can't. Because when you're looking at the sky, you're looking at a zone of the stratosphere above you, but the ice crystals may not fill that entire field of view. Ice crystal fields are like clouds in the lower atmosphere. They migrate across the sky following the air circulations up in that part of the atmosphere. So as they move over your location, your viewing site, you may see the halo start as a very weak ring, probably not even complete, because the edge of the ice field will be thinly populated, the crystals farther apart, and you won't get a continuous ring. And then as the field moves across and is moving centrally over you, or over the sun, you will get the complete halo. Or the field may miss the sun, passing obliquely, and you get a halo arc on one side, and it's missing or very weak elsewhere. And that will change as the ice field moves across, in the same way that a cloud moves across the sun, and you get greater or lesser sunlight on the ground. So the halo is not necessarily a static apparition. It's a kinetic one, which would be delightful if you chance to catch it when it first breaks out. And it can break out pretty quickly. I mean, I've known instances where I've looked at the sun or the sky near the sun at one street corner, and then by the time I get to the next street corner, waiting for the traffic light, I look again, and there is a halo trying to break through. So I'll dawdle at that corner, and I see if the halo gets stronger and brighter and more colorful. And then I go to the next corner, it's still there. Go to the next corner, it's gone, it's faded. By the duration it took me to walk maybe 90 seconds from one block to the next, I'm talking about the short blocks in Manhattan, then the halo vanished because the ice field drifted away. That makes it pretty tough to alert others to the apparition. It's more like, say, a northern lights display. You see a glow in the north, oh God, I gotta tell everybody else. So you send text messages to other observers, or you post it on their hotline, and everyone's roused up. By the time they get outside, the aurora could have faded away. Or it could have blossomed into a larger display, or it could be a quiescent one that lasts for an hour or so, giving people a chance to see it. So solar halos are like that. The difference with aurora is at least we can monitor the solar activity, the influx of electrons, sunspot cycle, and we can anticipate and we say, okay, let's be on lookout for aurorae because a big eruption came off the sun heading our way. We cannot do that for solar halos. The meteorology did not develop a monitoring or warning system for solar halo or atmospheric optics. You're on your own, and it's by chance that you see one. But that is how the 22-degree halo is formed. Now, as the crystal rotates roughly perpendicular to the page, you will get different amounts of deviation, and this broadens the halo. So if you see a broad halo, a degree or so in width, it's because these crystals are really rotating rapidly. And if you see a very narrow one, it's because the halos are, the crystals are kind of stable and still, and they're relying on their numbers and density to give you the full display. Hence, it's interesting to note that standing on the ground using bare eye and maybe rudimentary angle measurements, like I say, using your fist or the ruler, you can actually collect useful intelligence about the atmosphere in the stratospheric layers. A very important property of refraction is shown in slide 16. Sunlight emits essentially all wavelengths of visible light, a spectrum. And it's a continuum spectrum, and in the case of the sun, you have dark lines across it for the absorption by atoms in the corona above the photosphere. So you're going to get, when you refract light, as you would in a spectroscope using prisms, and diffracting in a diffraction grating instrument, dispersion of the output rays according to wavelength. So a refractive caused feature of a solar halo is spectrally or rainbow colored. A reflective caused solar event, optic event, is monochrome, nominally white, because all the wavelengths of light will be reflected in the same way. Now, it may not be white, it may be yellow or brown, depending on the amount of pollution or water vapor is in the lower atmosphere. Because these rays in the stratosphere have to come down to us through the schmutz in the lower atmosphere, where all your weather takes place and where a lot of your pollution is trapped. And so the colorations will be biased by the tinting imparted by the lower atmosphere. But at least it's a single color for reflection only, and for features which are caused by refraction and also combined refraction and reflection, you will get features with spectral colors, again filtered through whatever's interfering in the lower atmosphere. Over the years, people ask me, well, why can't I see the dark lines? I look at the halo in binoculars or a lowest power eyepiece in the telescope, I don't see the dark lines. Well, you won't. All these diagrams and even the mathematics of explaining these halos assume that the sun is a point. It isn't. It's a disk, half a degree in diameter. So what's happening is you have a pencil of rays coming in, each one of which makes its own dispersed spectrum, and they overlap. Only at the end, the red or the blue, will the interference and overlap be the least. So you may get a dazzling red inner edge of the halo, some gradation of color, and with white somewhere in the middle, and then you get the greenish, green, blue, and violet at the outer edge. The white in the middle is where the overlapping of all the rays from that finite sized disk is greatest. Okay, if you look at slide 17, this you can play with yourself. The shows the deviation of the sunlight on opposite sides, left or right, or top and bottom of the sun. Now, if you want, especially if you have a mobile device, lay it so that it faces upright, and if you can imagine rotating it along that center line, direct view of the sun, you can simulate that crystals are arranged all around the sun. So you would get these deviated points of light at all the clock hour positions around the sun, and you could get the effect illustrated in the cartouche in the upper right corner, where you have all the dots blend together into a ring. Now, I mentioned the fields of ice. These are many kilometers diameter. In other words, they vary in size as much as ordinary clouds do, from maybe a kilometer or so to tens of kilometers, which accounts for the very erratic duration. You may see a halo bloom out, and 20 seconds later it fades away, in the same way that you may see a cloud pass over the sun and takes about 20 seconds to move off and expose the sun again. Or you may see a duration of a feature for an hour or more, in the same way that you have a sky which is partly sunny. Certain hours of the day is sunlighted, and other hours you have clouds over the sun and probably no clear space. It also accounts for why, if you have observers over a wide area, over a large city or a county, you give the alert because you saw a halo, and your buddy 10 kilometers away, he goes out and there's nothing. If he had smarts, by listening to this seminar, he would stay out there and see if the ice field would then move over to his viewing location, or, horrors, he missed the show because the halo appeared before he got the alert. So it is a hit-and-run exercise when observing halo phenomena. A very curious feature of solar halos is shown in slide 18. If the sky is actually clear, no haze, no moisture, and yet blue sky around, the sky inside the halo is darker than the sky outside. So the upper picture in 18 gives a whole halo, and if you sit back a bit, yes, it's darker inside the halo. The lower picture from a different picture shows an arc of the halo, the lower edge of it, and quite plainly the interior is darker. It also shows a little better the spectral colorations. You can use mild zoom, but you're not going to get more texture or structure, but you may bring out nuances of coloration or shape that you didn't catch by bare eye. If anything, if you have choices of field of view, use a wide-angle lens to take in 60 or 90 degrees of sky. That's why in these pictures of halos, the halo covers, small or large, or overspills the field of view. If the sky has haze, or there's like a whitish film over the sky, or there's much air pollution, that homogenizes the sky brightness, and then you may get no distinction inside or outside of the halo. But it's something to look for. If you actually see in blue sky around there, notice that the halo inside is noticeably darker than outside. We have here, slide 19, a rare event where the sun has two halos. This was taken with a rather wide-angle lens. It's something like a, I don't know what, but the 46 degree radius halo is the outer dimmer one. So the whole field has to be something more than 90 degrees. And the inner obvious halo is 22 degrees. Now, they don't necessarily appear together. It has happened that you get the outer 46 degree without the 22 degree, and because it is thinner and weaker, it is more often missed. But anytime you see a 22 degree halo, look another radius out if there is a 46 degree halo. That too is a refraction event, and slide 20 will show the mechanics of it. Near the top is an ice crystal, and the sunlight enters through a side face and leaves after refraction and dispersion through the base or end face, and the angle between the two, the prism angle, is 90 degrees, not 60 like for the 22 degree halo, and the deviation ends up being 46 degrees. The 22 degree halo is shown for comparison. So if you see a 46 degree halo, that is in your face. If the sun is halfway up in the sky, and assume that the whole halo is visible, it will stretch from horizon to the zenith. Or if the sun be in high sky, it would be a ring completely surrounding the sky, roughly 45 degree altitude. So it's something to keep an eye out for. Many people miss these displays because they see one part of it and they don't say, step back and look around. There could be more. We'll now look at one other kind of halo display, a feature of a halo display. There are dozens of varieties. So in the short time that I've got here for you people, I'll just explain in detail too. We did the halo, and this is now in slide 21, the parhelia, or sun dogs, or false suns, or mock suns, because these and 21 are brilliant spots left and right of the sun, and typically they're just outside the 22 degree halo. You hear the 22 degree halo, and these are at the outer edge of that formation. They are also caused by the same optics as the halo, except that the ice crystals, these are columns now, are standing vertically. There could be some jumbled up ones, that's why you got the halo, but there'd be a large fraction of them are preferentially vertical, and they rotate around the vertical axis, so therefore spots on the left and right would be much brighter than the rest of the halo. They are called parhelia for plural, or parhelion in the singular. They too are spectrally tinted because they, like the halo, are refractive caused phenomena. You may see one or both, and if you do see both, they may be of different brilliances and color saturation. Again, that's the migration of a block of ice crystals drifting over you. As an example, imagine a ice field which covers the lower left quadrant of this picture. You would see the left or dextrum, I'm sorry, sinistrum parhelion, because parhelion is neuter, but you would not see the dextrum on the right, where the ice, at least the vertical columns of it, did not reach that area, or will not, depending on its path across the sky. Again, you have the kinetics of this, that during the display, the parhelia will wax and wane in brilliance until they finally do disappear. Okay, curiosity will kill you? Yes, it does. Many of the, or actually most, in sheer numbers, of pictures of halo phenomena include the skyline under it for a very simple reason. When the sun is at low altitude, it becomes part of your landscape. As you go about your daily life and you see the surrounds, oh, there's the sun. Wow! A halo! When the sun is in the high sky, unless there's a particular reason for you to look up, like following birds or an airplane or architectural detailing on a tall building, then you would not notice the halo. That does not apply to you folk, because you're going to keep a watchful eye when you are outdoors on a clear day during daytime. You're going to deliberately scan the sky for atmospheric optical effects. I mentioned that the presence of the minor halo and parhelia depends on the proportion of the ice columns that are standing upright to those which are all jumbled up. So in slide 22, we see two examples where the great bulk of the vertical ice crystals are producing parhelia, and there's only a minor amount to make the halo. So the upper picture in slide 22 show good parhelia, but only short arcs of the halo. The upper part and the lower part are missing, showing that most of the crystals are indeed vertically arranged. The lower picture gives a more extreme situation where essentially all the ice crystals, you know, over the sun are vertical, and essentially none left to make a parhelion. To emphasize again the mechanism of parhelia, slide 23 is pretty much the same as the one earlier to show the 22 degree halo, but in this case, imagine the screen horizontal, so that if you look along that midline, direct line of sight, the ice crystals are to the left and the right, and we're looking at the end faces pointed up. The fellow watching this is probably stretched out on a park bench. That's why he's horizontal. You get the same effect as the 22 degree, except only on the right and left, same altitude as the sun, as we see in the little cartouche in the upper right. Now, I mentioned that you don't need strong zoom or magnification when photographing or documenting optical effects in the air, the solar halo phenomena. But on occasion, a low magnification can be useful. Slide 24 has a detail of a parhelion dextrum. That means right side. Dextrum on the right, sinistrum on the left. Okay, this note the beautiful spectral color, not very strong color, but it's pretty obvious. There is a rainbow-like tinting, and you'll see it is just outside the 22 degree halo. We're looking at the right edge of that halo, and you see an arc stretching off to the right. That arc is monochrome, white, which shows that it is a reflection effect. What's happening there, the vertical faces of those ice crystals, depending on the angle of attack by the sunlight, reflects off of them and does not enter into the crystal, and therefore all the wavelengths stay combined, whatever the color of the sun, which is hidden by an obstacle on the left-hand side. This recalls a really hysterical incident many, many years ago when my office was near Foley Square. My window faced uptown on Manhattan, which is north-northeast. The sun normally does not shine into the window during the work day. It does so in the early morning hours, but at this time I get a phone call and the sun was not on my window. I couldn't see it. It was from my lady love, God bless her soul, who has or had a garden house on Manhattan. You visit her all the time, whatever. And she was in a total panic. She was entertaining some friends in her garden with drinks and snacks. And the best I could make out from her frenzied monologue was that one of their friends pointed in the sky and saw this gigantic comet. Now, among the things I had to do for the good lady was keep her apprised of celestial event that you can see by eye or binoculars, because from her airy, she could see a good slice of sky because her garden house was a little higher than most of the surrounding buildings. And she thought that somehow I failed her by not pointing out this comet, and it took her by surprise. Okay, since I couldn't see the sun or the sky, because she described it, it was a sinistrum perihelion, which I found out in a few minutes. It was on the left side of the sun. Any case, so I said, okay, look, let me look at it, and I'll get back to you. So I went down to the street, sunny side of the building, looked up to the left side of the sun, and yes, there was a perihelion sinistrum, like this picture turned upside down, and it was gorgeous and beautiful and all that, and I could see how an uninitiated person would call this a comet, because it had a brilliant head, you know, with all sparkling colors, and a streaming tail, and most people think of a comet's tail as smoke trailing behind the comet, so the comet looked like it was heading for the sun. So then I went upstairs, called my lady love, looked it out. You were very, very right to call me, and very, very right to be perhaps surprised by it, but it is not a comet. There is no bright comet around the sky now, but you saw something that in many ways is more infrequent. And I told her it was a perihelion sinistrum. I have to say, the good lady was very well educated, and she understood that it meant the left-hand side near the sun, which is literally kind of what the words mean. And I explained about the ice crystals and all that. And then she was satisfied, and she thanked me, and she went back to her, and she probably then boasted to her friends, man love called me back, and blah, blah, blah. And she explained all about the ice crystals and how they make like little prisms and all of that. And I suppose the rest of their entertainment on the garden went off pretty well. So if you have a friend, whether it's an emotional attachment, just a neighbor, who's kind of interested in the sky, it might be well to keep in general informed of what's going on up there, but you will get surprised, like a northern lights display, or like in this case a perihelion, or a very bright meteor that explodes. You can't predict that. Pictures 25, 26, and 27 give examples of a very common phenomenon which are mistaken for atmospheric optics. 25 shows the sun with most of bits and pieces of the 22 degree halo, but just by chance, the way the photographer was located in the ground, it's bracketed by two contrails. They are not atmospheric ice crystal effects. They're simply the ejecta from airplanes, whether condensation, which is what contrail is contracted from, or deliberately spraying this or that substance into the air. You can tell the difference because halo phenomena are symmetrical left and right from the sun. That is, what appears on the left side of the sun should be mirrored on the right side, assuming that the same effect is on both. I mentioned that the perihelia, you may see one or the other, and for halo, you may see only part of the arc and not the rest. But if you could fill in the entire formation, it would be mirrored left and right. That's one clue. Another is that the contrails are much lower in the sky, typically. Airline flights are up in the 10 kilometer range anyway, so it's the same height as the ice crystals, but they may drift differently from the ice field. So if they drift and move relative to the sun, then it is not a halo feature. Halo features are stationary relative to the sun. Now, as the sun moves in diurnal rotation, the entire display, assuming that it endures long enough, will go with the sun. Its contrails will move in some other direction. And if you have binoculars, or maybe, or better, sharper eyes, you see this on the left contrail, it actually shows structure and texture. It's made of, it's puffy material. It's more like a cloud rather than an optical light. And on the right, we see that the contrail changes in thickness. Now, the contrail, when this picture was taken, probably started at the bottom of the picture, and the airplane that made it went upwards, and it's behind the trees you see in the upper right. But as that happens, the contrail blooms out and becomes more cloud-like, whereas the front end where the plane was remains narrow and thin. So be careful with contrails being mistaken for halo phenomena. 26 shows again a sky with many contrails across it. I have no idea where the photographer for this picture was. Maybe it's near a military base, or maybe there's a farm nearby and they're spreading fertilizer or insecticide. Or, as I have been hearing, but not getting very much positive information, that stuff being spewed out is supposed to reflect sunlight away from the ground and inhibit or retard global warming. Others tell me that no, it's a chemical that reacts with the carbon dioxide and precipitates as salt and removes the carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and again reduces global warming. And I have no idea what the validity of that statement is. In any case, these are not halo phenomena. And in, what's your question over there? What's that? Oh. That's a good one, yeah. Someone in the peanut gallery mentioned that the contrails could possibly have been a way of high altitude, 8-9 kilometer height, chaff to impede the leakage of radio transmission from military bases and thwart the overflights of Chinese balloons, which might try to monitor our military activity. So that is maybe a screen to block or confuse or jam leaked radio noise from the ground against being captured by enemy powers. Sounds good. Okay, 27, again, here are parallel contrails on the left. Again, they could fool the uninitiated to think they are atmosphere optics, but very obviously there's a smoky, puffy appearance to them. Then as time goes on, they would dilate and spread out and ultimately dissipate. and the acetate of all is look at the contrail. If you see the head of the contrail, look there, and you get a view on the right, the airplane that's jettisoning this stuff out. Actually, if you can enlarge that a bit, the smoke is not coming from the motors or the exhaust vents of the engine, but from separate little pipes or jets, as if it was a cargo type of material that's deliberately being sprayed into the air. And also, that's a kind of a large plane, like an airliner size airplane. So there's probably more to this story than I know. Well, here's Rainbow, slide 28. Rainbows almost have to be part of a discussion of atmospheric optics. Well, pedantically speaking, rainbows are caused in the atmosphere by the action of sunlight, but this time it's on rain droplets, not ice crystals, and the rain droplets are close to the ground, maybe a kilometer up or so. Unlike halos, you can anticipate, to the extent of deliberately going out and looking for them, rainbows. If you have a rain, especially a light rain, not a monsoon or a deluge, but a light pitter-patter type of rain, just about to the limit of what you can walk through without being really discomforted, or the drizzle that follows such a major rainstorm, and also that the clouds have moved off of the sun, so your sunlight is shining into the rain clouds that are now moving away from you. To go wet the next town. Then you face those clouds or aim toward your shadow, you could see in those clouds the rainbow, like we see in 28. Now, a rainbow is kind of interesting. It's a circuit. It's actually a complete circle, except that generally, below the horizon, you don't have the water droplets. If you're on a hill and you can overlook an area where it had rained and the rain is moving away, you can get the arc of the rainbow below your horizon, and you see that lies over ground features. You can also make your own rainbow with a garden hose set to a fine spray, and you aim that into your shadow. If you sweep gently in left, right, up and down, you can eventually trace out the whole rainbow. Now, a natural rainbow has a radius of 42 degrees. Now, that varies a bit depending on the exact shape of the raindrops, and also raindrops may not be pure water. It could be acid rain, so it's a very, very dilute sulfuric acid, or it could be a salt spray if you see the rainbow over the ocean. So the refractive property, the index of refraction as it's called, would not be that for water, it would be close to it, and therefore you would get a slightly different rate. You would notice it, so calling it 42 degrees is quite good enough. Now, the shadow of your head on the ground or across whatever's in front of you is the center of the circular for the rainbow. It's on the line from the sun through your own physical head, or more properly your eyes, and then down to the ground where your shadow is. So as long as the sun's altitude is less than 42 degrees, then you at least get some part of the arc above your horizon against the rain clouds. The lower down the sun is towards setting, the greater the arc will be, and in the limit with the sun about to set, you'll see a semicircle. That is why most rainbows are seen just after sunrise or a little before sunset, because you have the largest part of the arc in the sky above obscuring foreground structures and therefore more noticeable. Depending on the weather regime of your location, I'll use New York as an example. In the summertime, we frequently get late afternoon rain, and that rain generally travels west to east. So it first rains in New Jersey, then over the city, and then moves off into Long Island. Then by the time it moves away, it's late afternoon with a low sun, and that is when I myself most commonly see rainbows. So you may have to be more versed in the weather patterns to know what time of the day and under what conditions of rain should you make a point to get to some open area with a good sky view opposite the sun to find a rainbow. And rainbow indeed has the colorations of a rainbow. We do have 35 slides in this presentation, so we are getting close to the end. Right, slide 29 shows the mechanism to make a rainbow. We have a circular raindrop. Now, raindrops don't have to be that. They can be raindrop shape or ellipses of revolution and so on. That would distort the actual size of the rainbow. But again, like I said, calling it a 42 degree rainbow is quite satisfactory. Okay, so sunlight coming from the right near the top is refracted at the outer surface of the drop. Then on the left side of the drop, it's reflected from the inside surface. And on the bottom right, it leaves and suffers a second refraction. And because of the refraction steps in forming the rainbow, we get the dispersion of sunlight into its spectral colors. That's why the rainbow has those colors. The direction downrange from the sun, that is off to the left, and the angle of view from the lower right into the outgoing beam is at 42 degrees. It looks kind of correct, although I wouldn't swear that this is a scaled picture. It just illustrates how raindrops can do a reflect and give you the rainbow in the sky. In slide 30, the author annotated a photograph of a rainbow to illustrate a few of the features. He notes that there's a secondary rainbow outside the main one. It's a little thin in this picture, and depending on your display you may not even see it. It's a thin one. And that occurs if the rain was a dense, heavy rain, but has now receded a couple of kilometers away. So you have a dense cloud, if you will, of big water drops. And the refract path of the sun through that kind of a drop is somewhat different, and the angle of deviation is greater, more like around 55 degrees or thereabouts. And the colors would be reversed compared to the main rainbow. Photographing a rainbow is simply taking a snapshot directly at the sky where it appears. There's no special photographic skill. If anything, the rainbow may be a little underexposed. Now, in chemophotography, that was a fault, which actually ends up being a benefit, because when you underexpose a little bit in chemophotography, the colors in the landscape show up better. So that's better. Now, in digital photography, it doesn't matter all that much, because you can take the image and bring it into a photo processor and enhance the contrast and do something with the gamma function or the histogram and bring out the weaker detail. Now, having spoken a lot, and you heard my jabber about the halos, the parhelia, rainbows, what do you do with your observation? Or how do you make an observation? How do you record it? Well, believe it or not, I have been totally unsuccessful in finding a good, competently operated clearinghouse or reception center for halo phenomena observations. I once in a while, a website might open, "Oh, send your observations here." Okay. 2 months later, the site closed. Or, don't get it, it's empty. Still no reports. And no one has come up with a consistent way of measuring or otherwise collecting specs and parameters of these displays in a consistent way that meteorologists or climatologists, atmosphericians, I guess you call them, can study them and figure out the dynamics of the stratospheric regime. So what I myself have done is just do my own. Now, when I was new to watching the sky, the International Geophysical Year was still fresh in our mind. I was a member of it, along with thousands of other home astronomers, and we had recording forms for Northern Lights, which was a quadrant diagram of the sky on which you marked, according to the altitude and azimuth, the various aurora features. And there was some header information you put in the margins. And you mailed these to a central IGY aurora office. I genuinely forget where it was, but the address was right on the card. On the flip side was the address, and you put your return address in the corner and stick a 3-cent stamp on it, remember them, and that would be like a postcard which is mailed into the office. That no longer, or any forms that we have left, except our little souvenirs, like I kept a couple, they're all gone. So I cut my own here in slide 31, using a planetarium program where I turned off everything except the out azimuth grid. So, and then printed it. Well, actually I screen copied and turned into a picture in the video file. It shows the out azimuth grid, zenith at the top, horizon at the bottom, so that's 60 or so degrees arc on each side. The for halo phenomena, 0 degrees azimuth would be the direction toward the sun. It is not geographical north. And then the azimuth then would be to the left and right of the sun, and we have altitudes. And I made the spacing pretty coarse in order to leave enough white space for you to sketch in the various halo formations. And you can write on it any comments you have, or if you printed these out, you know, use the back of it for more. In the lower left, I ask for the date and the time of the observation, and also time zone. And then on the right hand side, the identity and location of the observer. So imaginarily I would write J. Pasmino in the lower right. The location would be Brooklyn, New York, and the lat longitude 40 degrees something or other, longitude 73 degrees something or other. And on the right hand side, if I happen to see a rainbow while I'm recording this, I put down there on the left side 2003 April 6 and 1445 Eastern Daylight Savings Time. And then put in, and of course if there's a major change, like we have a second sheet, new time, and stretch it in and so on. Unfortunately, there's no place that wants these in a consistent basis, so the best you can really do is, you know, mount these into your website, say along with any pictures you took, or put them in your club printed newsletter, call the local news media. They may show it on their evening news. Oh, this afternoon there's a giant halo, and this guy, John Pasmino, whoever the hell he is, made a sketch of them over here, and here's his picture. That's about the best you can do. And see, but that's just the nature of the way we treat halos. It's not like variable stars, not like, say, fireballs and bolides. It's not even like aurorae. So have some scheme of record. And of course, you keep these, make a folder in your computer or paper manila folder if you have these printed out. 32, you're going to have fun with this. The parhelia are bright spots on the 22-degree halo, or where the halo would be if the halo itself was not formed, but for elevation, let's say with angles, for higher altitudes of the sun, the rays do not enter the crystal perpendicular to the axis. The halo, the rays will come in horizontal when the sun is on the horizon, whereas the axis of the crystal is vertical. That you get it passes through a section of the crystal which is the geometrical hexagon. If the sun is at a higher altitude, the rays will penetrate the crystal at an angle, and the ray sees, or say passes through, an elongated hexagon, and the prism angle is more than 60 degrees. And that causes a deviation greater than 22 degrees, and the spots appear outside the halo. So this is a program, well, I originally wrote it in ZX Basic, which was the basic on my own first personal computer around 1980. And then I later transferred it to GW Basic, and ultimately when the IBM came out with the one that had Windows, Windows had built into it Quick Basic or Q Basic. The newer versions of Windows no longer have it, in the sense of if you do list programs or you do a search through the start menu, it doesn't show up. However, it is buried in there, at least up to Windows 2000 and Windows XP. If you go to the Windows directory and then do a search for QBASIC, and you'll find a couple files with that name, and what you do is you make a shortcut for the exec file and put that on your desktop or in a directory of useful programs. I have it in the folder called Language, which has GW Basic and also Word Basic. If you ever wondered how Word is able to manipulate text, it's because there's a Basic built into it, which is a full-fledged language in its own right, not just shoving characters around on the screen. Okay, so if you have another dialect of Basic, since most of the program is mathematics, which is essentially the same across all flavors, then you shouldn't have much problem with editing this to make it fit your Basic. The way you do this is where it says cut here, you do cut, that is computer cut, and then you paste it into the programming panel of your Basic, or into QBasic, and then save it, and then you just need to run. Now this program, plus what we discussed earlier, will constitute your quiz. But I warn you, it's going to be a tough one, but I know we got some pretty smart with it characters who take these seminars. So I may get some good feedback. So that's a program you can mess around with. 33 is a screenshot of one of many programs that will artificially simulate halos. No program is required, but it would really help if you boned up on stratospheric ice crystals. There are websites that describe them generally, although almost none even go into any detail regarding halos. They'll show you the 22 degree halo and then that's it. So doing this exercise, you learn a lot more than what you would casually find through the web. So the left panel, the upper left, you can manipulate the field of view. I said for all the sky, the perimeter of that circle is your horizon. The zenith is in the middle. They ask for the altitude of the sun, and you can also select the kind of crystals and the alignments. And what it does is it artificially sends sun rays from the proper altitude into a computerized cloud of crystals. And then it plots the exit beams from these crystals by their correct azimuth, and it will sprinkle it on the screen, like you see there, the halos and some arcs, and so on, to make halo displays. You could actually use this in conjunction with your observations. That is, you observe the halo phenomenon, and if you have one of these programs, simulate it for the associated altitude of the sun, and see if the features you observe match what was predicted. This assumes everything possible for the given altitude does in fact happen. Or you might find it by fiddling with the crystal parameters, you can get a display that does match your own. But it's kind of a lot of fun. There are many of these. This has a black and white display. There are others that will give you a nominal blue background and will give schematic spectral colors for the refractive features and a pearly white for the reflective features. Almost done. Slide 34 is a chart showing not just the halo and parhelia, but several other halo phenomena, which I didn't really elaborate on, but some of them were seen or hinted at in a couple of the previous pictures, the photograph pictures. And then the author who made this chart labeled many of them, and you can do web searches on them. The one to have the colored stripes to represent them are the ones which were made with a refractive type of process, and the plain white lines and arcs are those of reflect. Now, final picture is a photograph of a complex halo display, the kind that you would see maybe once in your entire life, and if it erupts over a town where nobody had ever experienced this, you're going to get an awful lot of police and 911 army calls for response. It looks like the sun is doing something really awful, or maybe the green men are coming down to get us, or what. See if you can use this picture of the real display and match up some of the features from slide 34. Now, while you may probably never see a display like this, or you certainly can't plan for it, it may not even be in your town. You may be on a trip somewhere, and the weather conditions there let you see a display like this, but then you either will never go back to that location, or the halo forming conditions were pretty unique or exceedingly rare. This can happen. A lady buddy, still with me, was in Miami, Florida, on a holiday or a visit. And from hotel, she went to this swimming pool, which was outdoors. And when she stepped outside into the sunlight, And she goes, everyone was either out of the water or just standing in the water, and they were yelling and ooh and ah and ah, what's going on up in the sky? So she pointed, looked up there, and she saw a big solar halo. Now, she didn't know what the halo consisted of and why it's there, but knowing me, her man buddy, she understood that these do occur, and she did see a couple when she was home here in New York. Well, some people there at the pool and elsewhere in Miami got so agitated that they ran to the local police or the community service office and demanded to know what's going on. And they had to get the director of the planetarium in Miami, I forget his name, and to come on evening news for an interview to explain what this is. The story would have ended right there, except for one big problem. The planetarium director had no idea what the hell it was. It was outside his astronomy knowledge, and he made it sound like it was something very mysterious, but don't worry about it anyway. Okay, that finishes our discussion on halos and similar phenomena. And now it is time for the quiz. This would be a little complicated, a little hard, but I throw it out because I know that among my readers, these are some pretty, really smart people. Go back to the slide with the computer program and hunt up the line in it that says something like for the word F-O-R H equal 0 to the word 2 T-O 60 step 2. That is, for H equal 0 to 60 step 2, which means the program will do a calculation in the range of H, that's the altitude of the sun, 0 degrees at the horizon to 60 degrees up, 2 degrees by 2 degrees. So it should do the calculation and issue the printout 0, 2, 4, 6, 8, etc. up to 60. My question to you is, why didn't I go up to 90 degrees, say for H equals 0 to 90, step 2? Why did I stop at 60? There are many ways to approach this. I presume that because halo study is a little out of the realm of ordinary home astronomy, you probably do not have a halo simulating program, which, by the way, embeds as a particle of its own code a program very similar to the basic code I give you here. So you use the basic code there, and for the hell of it, modify that for line around the area of 60 degrees. You don't have to go from 0 up to then beyond 60. You can start from, say, 50 degrees, 50, to 61 degrees, 62 degrees, whatever, and you can vary the step to, say, a single degree or to half a degree and so on, and see what happens little beyond 60 degrees. Now, that part I can tell you, the program will bomb out. So you have to study the math part, being careful to see what the definitions of the various parameters are. When the statement is, say, let such and such equal something, let such a such other thing equal something, and then pay attention to the trigonometric manipulation, the sines and the cosines and the arc tangents and figure out why does the program bomb out, and that will lead you into an understanding of why I haven't shown you any pictures of parhelia for an overhead sun. Now you remember way at the beginning of the lesson I showed a view of a solar halo seen above tall buildings, or what everyone else calls tall, but no parhelia. They were all low sun or sun at modest elevation. And then just let me know your results. So until next time, pray for clear skies.